Hello. In the beginning, Ron's one secular account was the Big Bang. All matter in existence today originated around 13,000 million years ago in a phenomenally hot, extraordinarily condensed primordial atom that exploded with incredible force. Hydrogen and helium were shot across the firmament. Gravity caused the gases to condense into clouds, and in these clouds the first stars were formed. Then galaxies came, and more galaxies in clusters, onwards and outwards, ever expanding. It's still expanding, runs the orthodox account, and may even be speeding up. It's still creating new galaxies, and it continues to colonize more and more infinite space, despite the fact that it's supposedly infinite itself. The word billions dominates all discussions here. So if our universe is expanding, what's it expanding into? If it's already infinite, how can it be getting any bigger? And is there really only one universe? With me to tackle some of the riddles of the universe is the Astronomer Royal, Professor Sir Martin Rees, Royal Society Research Professor in Astronomy and Physics at Cambridge University, and author of a new book, Our Cosmic Habitat. Also here is the independent theoretical physicist Julian Barber, recently published a book called The End of Time, and John Levin, advanced fellow in theoretical physics at the University of Cambridge, who has also just published a book on cosmology called How the Universe Got Its Spots. Martin Rees, as I understand it, one of the main planks of evidence for the support of the Big Bang theory is called redshift. Could you explain what redshift is?
It's the way in which we infer the universe is expanding. If I take a step backwards, we've known since 1920 that our universe consists basically of galaxies, each one being like our Milky Way, each one containing about 100 billion stars. And these galaxies are moving away from each other. What I mean by that is that if you imagine elastic strings joining all those galaxies, the elastic is stretching all the time. Now, how do we know this? The way we know it is that when we look at the light from these galaxies, then the further away the galaxy is, the more the light is shifted towards the red. And that's analogous to the famous Doppler effect we're familiar with in sound. If the police siren is moving away from you, it's got a slightly lower pitch, so it's that evidence which gives us the view that the universe is expanding. The other way to think of it, actually, is to think of this space stretching so that the galaxies are moving through a stretching space. But the evidence for expansion dates back about 70 years now, and I think this is one of the sort of bedrocks of modern cosmology.
If redshift tells us that the universe is expanding, what is there to tell us that it started with the explosion? I mean, going back, I know you've discussed it many times, many people have, but I wouldn't mind having another crack. What does it tell us about the Big Bang?
If the galaxies are moving away from us, then the naive assumption is that in the past they were closer together, and you can work out how long ago they would have been all on top of each other, as it were. And that time is about 13 billion years. So the natural interpretation is that everything was together at that time ago in the past. Now, of course, galaxies couldn't have existed in their present form back then, but the favoured view is that everything started off, as you said in your introduction, in a very hot, dense gas, and it expanded, and the gas cooled and diluted. And at some later stage, maybe after a billion years or so, the galaxy starts to form. So the favoured view, and other lines of evidence to support it, is that the universe is an evolving phenomenon. It started off at some finite time in the past, very hot, dense and compact. It's been expanding and cooling, and all the structures that we see around us and of which we are a part are the outcome of forces acting on the universe over this immense span of time.
We don't know the actual the actual time that the Big Bang occurred. We haven't a description of that, as it were, to use that word, moment.
No. If we extrapolate back into the past, then we imagine things getting hotter and hotter and denser and denser. 1 second after the Big Bang, the temperature would have been about 10 billion degrees, and the density would be about the density of water. And we're quite confident, actually, we've got quite a lot of evidence for extrapolating back that far. But if we go back still further to the first tiny fraction of a second, the first microsecond or even less, then, of course, the inferred conditions are much more extreme. And we then have less foothold in our known physics and in experiments. So when we get back very close to the beginning, then things become much more uncertain. And that's, of course, a fascinating question. We still want to understand why there was a beginning. We need to understand and probe that physics.
That's a fascinating question. This might be a totally stupid question, Martin, but here goes. What did the Big Bang bang into?
Well, that's one of these questions that we just can't answer, because it's fairly clear that when we understand the very beginning of the Big Bang, we have to jettison lots of common sense concepts. Maybe the idea that space has three dimensions, that time is something that just ticks away, and we'll have to go further and further for intuitions.
But if the Big Bang banged into space, as it were, then space was there before the Big Bang. So you shouldn't be as worried about the Big Bang as you're worried about... I know this is really colossally naive, but it does puzzle me.
Well, I think we do have to modify intuitions and realise that, as Einstein first taught us, space and energy are linked together. So we can't really think of space as in isolation from what's in it. And the ideas that people are now discussing about the early universe all involve the idea that, in a sense, space changes its structure and even emerges along with the material in the Big Bang.
Channel 11, what's your... Can I come to you with the same question?
Yeah.
Because although Martin is very lucid, it still hasn't clicked with me, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I'm kind of glad you did, actually. I was itching. It is what Martin said, which is that in the current models of the Big Bang, space itself is created. It's not that space is out there and matter merely rushes into space. The space on which we live is also created in the Big Bang. Now, one of the problems people have with that is they like this analogy of, let's say, there's a balloon that expands. And even the balloon analogy, the surface of the balloon is the space, and we envision it expanding into something. That's just a limitation of our being three-dimensional. Mathematically, you can sort out that it's completely possible to have a two-dimensional space, like a balloon, which expands into only two dimensions. It does not expand into a third dimension.
Do you think this is our lack of ability to imagine nothing?
Yeah, actually, that's a good point, because when people talk about what's on the other side of the universe, they've already metered out some amount of distance, and they've pointed to a place, which is in itself space. And if you really believe that space is mutable, evolving, can be born, can die, then that is part of the universe. It makes no sense to point to a place or point to a time and ask if it's outside space-time.
So it just gives you a headache to think there was nothing, doesn't it?
Yeah, and, yeah, I guess nothing is the ultimate problem.
Okay, right. So let's talk about how the galaxies... Do you want to say any more about that nothing?
No, I mean, nothing is the Teflon. I guess that is ultimately the difficult problem. It's hard for us to imagine nothing. It's hard for us to imagine that there was nothing before space
it's
and
interesting
time.
That when in the early philosophers talk about nothing will come of nothing, and Lear's nothing will come... I don't know. Right, anyway, never mind. Right, the universe, like the galaxies. If all matter originates from the same ball and the same explosion, why isn't it evenly distributed throughout the universe?
In a sense, it is evenly distributed throughout the universe. In the sense that we are nowhere is identifiably a center. If you have a star that explodes, like a supernova explosion, it's clear where the center of the explosion happened, and all matter accumulates on these shells, and it's not evenly distributed. In the Big Bang, by an enormous contrast, if space itself is created and matter is created in the Big Bang, then matter is, in a sense, roughly evenly distributed everywhere. There is matter in every point in space-time, and every point could equally well be the center. Later on, it starts to clump and form galaxies, and that looks kind of unevenly distributed on small scales, when we look in the scale of an individual galaxy or clusters of galaxies. But on the largest scales, those clusters seem to distribute themselves evenly throughout space.
Can you give us, have you any idea of the sort of contour of the galaxies, how many and so on? I mean, we're into the 100 millions and billions of stars.
Yeah, well, Martin would probably be good on this, but as far as we know, right, there are at least as many galaxies as there are stars in our own galaxy, which is a lot, billions, but they do seem to cluster in unusual ways. We do seem to find structures where there are voids, there are regions where there seems to be very few galaxies, and galaxies do seem to accumulate on a kind of web-like structure, filamentary structure throughout the cosmos. And that's part of the clues that we use to build models of galaxy formation and structural formation.
Right. Julian Barber, isn't there another mysterious factor involved in building galaxies? What is dark matter, and what does that do?
Well, here again, I would have to defer to Martin to be more really expert on saying that. There's a lot of evidence, this is also going back 70 years, good to a Swiss astronomer called Zwicky, who first saw the evidence for it in the 1930s. You can tell that there's matter around in the universe because of the gravitational effects that it has. I mean, there can be a completely invisible object, and you can see that it's there because things are whizzing around it. And essentially what Zwicky already observed in the 1930s was that the visible matter is moving around faster than it should if we can see all the matter that's in the universe. So there is well known to be, it's virtually certain that there is more matter in the universe than we can see, and it's got the name dark matter, and one of the really great mysteries is what it's made of and exactly where it is, and I'm not really the expert to talk about that.
I'll stay with you for a minute or two. What is the mainstream physics understanding of the force that causes the universe to be expanding, to expand?
Well, there's a rather naive idea that there was a big oomph at the start which sent it all flying, and since then the rate at which it flies apart is controlled by gravity. If there was enough oomph, it'll sort of go on forever and never come to rest. If there wasn't enough oomph, it'll fall back on itself and we'll go from the Big Bang to the Big Crunch. I have to say I'm beginning to get skeptical about that view, but that's the standard picture. You have to bear in mind that science comes in two parts, at least it does at the moment. You have the laws of nature or the laws of dynamics, and then you have initial conditions. So when you say what drives the universe apart, in the standard orthodox picture, it's the oomph you give it at the start.
So that's the kinetic energy.
That's the kinetic energy.
The matter that is formed causes a gravitational pull, and that matter includes dark matter, which adds to the gravitational
matter we can see and keeps
the thing together.
Yes, and there is this very fascinating thing that according to the standard picture we seem to be just about exactly on the dividing line between going on forever and falling back. I mean, sort of on the dividing line. And that's very mysterious. I might just mention, people are probably familiar with the concept of escape velocity. If you throw an apple up in the air, it'll come back to the Earth. But if you could really throw it with enough strength, it would just leave the Earth and reach infinity with no speed at all. And then if you were a real Superman, you could throw it out and it would go on forever and get to infinity at a high speed. So these are the three different cases. And that's quite analogous to what's happening, apparently, with the universe. And we seem to be rather mysterious, close to this, just precisely the transition from falling back or going all the way out to infinity.
There's a very nice layer of skepticism in your remarks. The word, use the word naive and mysteriously close. So that, if I can congratulate a minute or two, but go back to Martin. You write in your new book, Martin, quote, "We, the stars and the visible galaxies, are just traces of sediment, almost a seeming afterthought in the cosmos. Something quite different and still unknown controls its large scale structure and eventual fate." Now, those are tantalizing phrases, large-scale structure and eventual fate. What are you referring to? Is this the dark energy now from dark matter? It's like Dark Vader. We're on sort of Miltonic, Manichaean, Harry Potter terms here, aren't we?
Which is embarrassing that only...
Darth Vader, sorry, got him wrong again.
Only 4 or 5% of all the stuff in the universe is in the ordinary atoms of which we, the stars and the galaxies, are composed. All the rest is in some mysterious form. It now
Why do you use the word mysterious?
Well, because, as Julian said, the dark matter is something whose nature we don't fully understand. We suspect it's some sort of particles made in the Big Bang along with the atoms and the radiation, but we don't really know what it is. But we do know that there is more dark stuff in the universe than there is in luminous stars and galaxies, and that is one of the problems. But there's an even more mysterious issue that's come to the fore in the last few years, which is that this dark stuff is in two different kinds. There's the so-called dark matter, which holds the galaxies together, and this goes back to Fritz Zwicky in the 1930s, as Julia mentioned. But we've also discovered that even empty space itself has energy latent in it. And 70% of the mass and energy in the universe, as it were, is in empty space itself, not even in dark matter, still less in actual atoms. And this dark energy is governing the way the universe is expanding. with the rather strange effect that it's causing the expansion to speed up, because unlike dark matter, dark energy has a sort of negative pressure which tends to give a push rather than a pull. And so we have this rather complicated mixture. We have no idea why there is this mixture in the universe, but these are the three main ingredients.
Julian, you want to get in on that?
I just wanted to come in on one point there and make a point which I think absolutely must be remembered when we're talking about cosmology. There's very few observations which you can interpret without using some sort of theory. And the remark that Martin just made about this extra form of dark matter which causes the acceleration, that conclusion is drawn from using Einstein's theory as it exists now. And that is possibly dangerous. We, as Martin said, we're going to be moving into a very different arena when we really try to understand the universe at a deeper level than we do now. There is some unification, some deeper understanding is going to come. And I think it's almost certainly going to change the theory that we use to describe the universe. And therefore one must take these claims with a certain pinch of salt, because they're crucially dependent upon the theory that you use to interpret the observations.
Martin himself, you yourself said, Martin, in your book, I think it was, that this being in the 21st century is the most extraordinary time to be alive for doing cosmology, really.
I think so. There's a real crescendo of discoveries, and I think the basis is really improved observations. The theory is still rather fragile, and I completely agree with what Julian says, and really we ought to be prefacing our remarks by health warnings, as it were, and towards the end of this discussion I suspect we should say these more and more loudly as we get more speculative. But I think it is important to bear in mind why we've been able to make any progress at all in cosmology, why we can talk about the expansion of the universe and the average density of the universe. That's because of the remarkable contingency that the large-scale universe, as seen through our telescopes, does seem to have this kind of uniformity. We know that there are the galaxies, there are the clusters of galaxies, there are even superclusters of galaxies. But there are not clusters of clusters of clusters ad infinitum. In a broad brush sense, the universe does genuinely seem smooth. Let me give an analogy. If you're in the middle of an ocean, you may look around you and see very complicated waves, long swells, and smaller waves riding on top of them. But even the biggest wave is small compared to the horizon distance. And so you can still talk about the average properties of the part of the ocean out to your horizon. In contrast, if you're in the middle of a mountain range, you can't do that, because one big mountain dominates the entire view. And we've only made any progress in cosmology. It only makes sense to talk about our observable universe, because in this analogy, our universe is like the ocean surface, not like the mountain range. We can talk about averages. We can observe a big enough volume of space to get a fair sample of what it contains.
We're always having an oblique view in that sense.
Right.
John Levin, can I ask you, one point in your book, you are very emphatic. You write, the universe cannot be infinite.
Well, that's probably too emphatic for my own good.
I'm not sure you're right.
Yeah, and that's true. I did write that. It's not that I think that there's empirical or logical evidence that suggests that it's impossible for the universe to be infinite. It's just that I think it's an untenable idea. If you think about an infinite universe, it becomes extremely peculiar. If there's an infinite universe, it means that there are infinite possibilities. It means that somewhere else there's a galaxy just like this galaxy. It means that there's an infinite number of these galaxies. And there's an infinite number of planets that look infinitely close to the Earth, and somewhere there's people sitting around table having a discussion about infinity. And it just becomes this kind of absurdist notion, and that might not be pressing enough, but it does start to hint that something's wrong. And
something's wrong because we can't understand it.
No, not just because we can't understand it, because infinities seem to be very dangerous things. We usually mark infinities as the failure of a theory.
But then we're measuring our understanding against our own minds. Maybe we're not able to understand.
Well, it actually kind of works. I think of it more as the theory. It's possible that we might just come to a place where we can't understand something, in which case science will give up. I think that the scientific impulse is to believe that that's never going to happen. And it's brash, but it does give us progress. And so one of the things we can do, for instance, is look at where Einstein's theory does begins to break down at things like the Big Bang, where Martin was discussing the very, very first moment. It's not something we can talk about precisely, because the theory starts to give answers that we no longer trust. They're not as predictive. There's infinite singularities, there's infinite curves, infinite energies. And this is an infinity that's not as bad, but is on a similar footing.
Julian Barber, your theory seems to support the notion of a finite universe. Is that modern?
Actually, I just wanted to come in and in some senses, back up what Jan has just said, but also throw in one further comment. I'm myself too very attached to the idea that the universe is finite, but that might just be a reflection that my mind is finite.
Yeah.
There is something extremely appealing about a finite self-contained universe because, in a wonderful expression of Einstein, then you have a chance of closing the circle of cause and effect. You can, so to speak, find a total explanation of everything within that. This is hugely attractive. And my life's work really has been devoted to trying to understand the universe in such terms. But every now and then I look at myself with disgust and say, it's just because you're a finite little worm and you can't comprehend the infinite. So there may be a danger in that, but I very much feel in sympathy with what you said, Joanna.
If I could just respond to that very quickly. I mean, infinity is a brilliant notion mathematically, so don't reject the notion mathematically, for instance. And it was rejected for a long time when Cantor first came up with the idea of infinity in an operational way where he was trying to use it mathematically, make arithmetic out of infinity. He was really rebuffed. I mean, there was not a lot of support for him. He ended up a very unhappy man in a lot of mental institutions. But he shaped modern mass with his understanding of infinity. So it is a very deep idea. I just think physically we never see infinity in nature, and that the universe was born, as are all of its progeny, and that we are all finite, and everything within this cosmos is finite. And I don't believe that a unified theory, which will see gravity, space, energy and matter, all as different reflections of the same thing, will create space infinite, but everything else finite.
First of all, in praise of the infinite, there's that wonderful saying of David Hilbert, we hope the mathematicians will be never driven from the paradise of the infinite.
That's beautiful.
I think it might be interesting to put this in a historical perspective. There have really been only about three great cosmological models in the whole of human thought. The first really clear one is Aristotle's, which is the self-contained spherical universe, and that was sort of the shell of the stars we see.
And then it was an outermost sphere, the outermost sphere, the Uranus.
And beyond that, there was literally nothing, no space, no anything. I mean, there might just be gods out there, but nothing else beyond that. Then you get the changeover in the 17th century to the infinite space of Euclidean space and atoms moving in it. And that was then the dominant paradigm until Einstein comes along, and in amazingly goes back almost exactly to Aristotle with his closed universe model, which started modern relativistic cosmology in 1917. And that's very interesting. But there, in the meanwhile, the mathematics had come along, because there was always a mathematical problem with the Aristotelian cosmos. There's this idea of the people saying, yeah, but if you got up onto the Uranus and threw a javelin through it, you know, it would go on into something.
Mm-hmm.
But then in the meanwhile, mathematics had advanced so fantastically, and the idea of non-Euclidean geometry, and one could see that in a way the surface of the Earth or the surface of a balloon is a very good model of space, of how you can have a self-contained space, so that Einstein's model was then mathematically on a far more secure footing. So that's very exciting, but the fascination of the closed universe persists.
Martin?
I share the prejudice in favour of a finite universe, but because we've got to bear in mind it could be finite but much larger than what we actually observe.
Absolutely.
The universe that astronomers can study, although it contains these billions of galaxies, is still of course finite, and there could be a lot more beyond what we can so far observe, even in a universe that's not infinite but actually finite. And as far as Jana's concept of the replicas of ourselves, you can work out the combinatorial possibilities and show that even in an infinite universe you would have to go to a distance far, far bigger than our telescope can reach before you got a duplicate of ourselves, because of all the possibilities, which are a vastly bigger number, even the number of stars in the visible universe. So there's no empirical argument against an infinite universe, and many of the ideas currently popular do suggest a finite universe, but nonetheless much larger than the horizon of our observations.
Well, you're talking about a finite universe in which the redshift still shows we're expanding. So it's a finite universe which is still expanding.
Absolutely.
So that theoretically is possible it keeps expanding forever. We could sensibly call it an infinite universe.
Well, if it goes on forever, but of course it may expand for much, much longer in the future than it has up till now, but not an infinite time. At the moment, the simplest theories do suggest that the long-range forecast is an ever-emptier universe that goes on forever. But even in cosmology, long-range forecasts aren't entirely reliable.
Almost take a break, just to bring us back to Earth for 2 minutes before we go on with the rest of these questions. What does this mean for us, this infinite, for us here on Earth? I don't mean us in the studio, although I wouldn't mind knowing what's in store for us either. But what does it mean for Earth, this expanding, and in any sensible projected future? I mean, can we get anywhere outside these billions, or are we actually straitjacketed into billions?
Well, the expansion of the universe doesn't affect our Earth or solar system, or even our galaxy, because within our galaxy, material is much denser than on average in the universe, and gravity holds it together against any other possible cosmic force. So our own galaxy isn't participating in this expansion. If the universe were to recollapse on top of us, we would know about it, of course, but that won't happen for many billions of years. Our universe is unaffected, our galaxy is unaffected by the expansion of the universe, but its long-range future depends on whether the universe does continue expanding forever. The stars may not all have time to die before the universe collapses, in some theories.
It just reminded me of a Woody Allen quote where he won't do his homework because he says the universe is expanding, and his mother says, "You live in Brooklyn. Brooklyn is not expanding. Do your homework." And that's pretty much the reality of it. Brooklyn's not expanding, and the Earth is not expanding. As Martin said, the solar system is not expanding. We have the local forces are more important than this global expansion.
I'd like to give another Woody Allen quote from my book, which is that eternity is very long, especially towards the end.
So you think it's a finite, but you think it's still expanding, Julian?
Now, I would really like to come in and really question this dogma that the universe is expanding.
Good.
Because, let me start with an interesting historical...
What do you call it, dogma? You just think it's an accepted... Well, you think it's dogma, yeah.
Well,
what a stupid question.
I should think those professional scientists who are listening to me are thinking I'm committing scientific suicide by questioning that the universe is expanding now when I say it. But I think there are very good reasons to be very skeptical, and even if I'm wrong and the universe truly is expanding and nature proves me completely wrong, I think we need to get to the bottom of this because it will be an important insight. Let me start with a historical observation that when they first saw the redshifts in the 20s, in fact in the teens of the last century, they came up with a completely different explanation for the redshift. The expansion, the stretching of space idea only came in the early 30s. In Einstein's general theory of relativity, there are two so-called redshifts. One is due to stretching of space, but the other is a purely gravitational effect. It's well known that clocks on the surface of the Earth run slower than clocks in satellites going around in the global satellite positioning system. And in fact, aircraft now can only land safely because they take into account these effects of Einstein's theory in working out exactly what's going on and where aeroplanes are. And that's called a gravitational redshift. So there are two possible explanations. And in fact, for a decade, people thought that it was the gravitational redshift, not a stretching redshift, that was explaining the expansion. So that's first of all, there is potentially an alternative explanation for the redshift within Einstein's theory, and it was the one that was first invoked. Now, secondly, the idea that the universe as a whole is expanding is a very odd idea, and frankly, I think it stinks. For the following reason, if I hold this plastic mug up that I've got in my hand here, I can move it around in this room, I can twist it, I can move it, and I can imagine it getting larger and smaller, and that is all totally meaningful for me in this room, because I can compare it with you and the walls. But if that plastic mug was the whole universe, and there was nothing outside it with which to compare it, all of those three operations I've described of moving, rotating, and getting it larger or smaller is completely meaningless. If, as Jana argues, the universe is self-contained, or it's internally denominated, to use a grand philosophical expression, what does it mean to say that it expands? So I think this is very suspicious, and one should be looking for theories in which the universe is not expanding, but it's just changing its shape. Shall I go on just a little bit more, or do people want to come in?
Well, I wanted to take issue with some of that. I mean, for instance, there's more than just the redshift that's now measuring things like the expansion of the universe. There's also gravitational lensing, for instance, where you have these enormous
galaxies.
Gravitational lensing, where you have these enormous galaxies between us and, let's say, a very, very distant quasar. And the light from that quasar is being bent by the presence of this gravitational lens. It is bending space around it, and so the light is taking varied paths. And from looking at these signals of these gravitational lenses, we can measure things like time delays. We can try to deduce, again, an expansion in a distance. Is that right, Martin, or am I muddling that a bit?
I'd like to come in with, well, give my take on, Julian. I think it's very important to think what we do mean by expansion, but I think there are two points that Julian's missing out. One is that we have lots of independent evidence that nothing in the universe is infinitely old. The older stars, we can age fairly reliably. We know they have enough fuel to last a certain length of time. And if we had a universe that had just been sitting there for the infinite past, we'd have to have some implausible story whereby all the stars turned on at some time 10 or 12 billion years ago in synchrony. So I think if there's not an original event, we still have to have an origin in time, which is hard to understand. And also, I think conceptually, Julian is finding it hard to understand the expansion because he has left out 90% of other physics. If you put nothing in physics apart from a continuum of space, then it's true there's no scale. But we know that the universe contains atoms.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say the universe is big and getting bigger, I mean it's getting bigger compared to atoms, and it's big in that it contains a number of atoms that's measured by a one followed by about 80 zeros. So that's what I mean when I say the universe is big, and that gives a scale to it. So I think we know that there is some other measure of scale in the universe set by atoms and by the quantum. So you can't divide space infinitely. You can't divide time infinitely, probably. There is a sort of underlying graininess. And when we say the universe is big and expanding, we mean that its scale is getting larger compared to that underlying scale. I mean, I think that Julian is missing that out, and just as Einstein was premature in his attempt to get a unified theory because he wasn't putting enough physics, I suspect that Julian is going to run up against the same problem.
I think it's over to you, because I'm going to help you here.
Well,
can you reply? Because it's a very... Martin made two strong points. So
let me start with the second one, because that'll be fresher in the listener's memory. On the question of the scale that the atom set, there's no question whatever that that is true, Martin. I'm not for 1 minute questioning that. What I'm questioning, but that's at what I would call an empirical level of science, not at the deepest level. We just have to accept that's there. If there is truly a quantum theory of the entire universe, I think it is extremely likely it will explain where those atomic scales come from, and it will do it out of a theory in which there is no scale. And therefore, it may well be premature to talk like this, and after all, Einstein was searching for his unified field theory 70 years before it was, and maybe I shall have to wait for my triumph when I'm pushing up the daisies. So that's the answer to your first one. The second one about the evidence that the universe was very different in the past and that stars formed and galaxies formed and so forth, this I really would say does belong to bedrock, and I wouldn't want to question that at all. But let me just point out that in the current picture, two things are happening in the universe. The first is that it's allegedly expanding, but secondly, it's doing what I call changing its shape. This program is called The Shape of the Universe. And it's changing the shape from being apparently extremely uniform to being much more clumpy. It's still uniform on the large scale, but there's much more clumpy detail. Now, what I'm saying is that the only thing that is actually happening is that the shape is changing, and it's not expanding as well. And therefore, I have a past perfectly well. My past is when the universe is completely uniform, or as uniform as it can get. And then we don't measure things by time, because I don't believe that exists, but we measure it by what we can see out there, the structures we see out there. I don't think there's any question that the universe looked totally different in what we call the past. That's fine. So I'm just measuring it by that level of graininess that is in the universe. That's my measure of time. So that, I believe, are my answer to your two
very good points, Martin.
Well, I was also going to say that the microwave background, which is this cosmic radiation left over from the Big Bang, is also one of those persuasive arguments for a Big Bang that happened everywhere and the universe that is expanding and cooling. It's very, very hard to explain the microwave background in a model that does not have those properties, doesn't have a hot beginning and in a subsequent expansion to today. So this radiation, just for people who are listening, does surround us in every direction. It has roughly the same temperature wherever we look, as far as we can ascertain. It fills the entire space uniformly. And it's a very important relic from the origin of the universe.
That's absolutely true. And at the moment, I have to be absolutely honest, I can do no more than wave my hands in answer to that point.
It's a question.
But let me just say, though, that if the universe really is explained quantum mechanically in its totality, we're only just beginning to comprehend how that might happen. And I don't rule out that that would be the case. Let me just say that in quantum mechanics, it's shapes, really, that determine everything. I see the universe as being really like some huge molecule in a governed by quantum mechanics. And if you look at the quantum mechanics of molecules, you see that things like the most uniform shape it can have, in some senses, is very dominant and is a vital factor in determining the shapes that do actually emerge. These all of the shapes count in determining the shapes that are actually realized. And there's no shadow of doubt in my mind that the quantum mechanics of the entire universe will be dominated by the most uniform state that it can possibly have. And this is why I think we emerge from such a big bang.
I just want to move on. Have you something of the utmost? I mean, I don't think I give him much more urgent than that. I want to come to you to tell us in this final lap of the program about the anthropic principle, what it is, and why it's astonishing, and what you make of it, really.
I should say that the term anthropic principle makes some physicists foam at the mouth. I'm not sure if that's true of my fellow panelists, and so I prefer to avoid using that word. But the reasoning or the thoughts behind this are that when we look at our universe, it does seem as though it is, in a sense, rather specially tuned for life, as it were, biophilic. Julian already mentioned the way the expansion speed seems to be neither too fast nor too slow, so there wasn't a big crunch soon after the beginning, and it's not expanding so fast that gravity loses its purchase and can't form galaxies. So that's one apparent bit of tuning, and as one looks into it, there are other respects in which the laws seem to be rather special, in order, in the sense that were they different, we can imagine a universe that would be rather sterile and stillborn, where there could be no stars, no atoms, no complex chemistry, etc. And the question is how we react to that. I think
we're talking about a number of minor differences all along the way. Not minor differences, a number of precise calculations, as it were, all along the way that make it precisely possible for you to be sitting here breathing and talking today, aren't we?
That's right.
And
if you imagine,
they're all on the edge. They're all, if you take two little bits of that out, or one little, not even a degree, fraction of a fraction of a fraction of that out, there'll be no you, no talking, no today kind of thing.
Yes, we've got to be open-minded about all other possible kinds of life and complexity, but certainly you can imagine tuning the knobs differently so that you could end up with a universe that would certainly allow no complexity. So there is this special feature about universe. Now, what does it mean? What it means, I think, will depend on the answers to the profound questions Julian is raising. What's the nature of the bedrock laws of nature? Some people suspect that there will be laws of nature which describe in a unique way all the important features of atoms and gravity and the other forces. If that's the case, if the laws are all unique, then we just have to say it's a brute fact that the universe is the way it is. It's a brute fact, or it's cosmic design. But the alternative possibility is that when we have this underlying theory, which Julian addressed, it may tell us that the cosmos is a still grander scheme than what we traditionally call the universe, and that there are bedrock laws of nature, but what we call the laws of nature in our universe are just, as it were, local bylaws, and that there are many other universes the outcome of separate Big Bangs, or maybe separated from us in some extra dimension, which are governed by different laws. And if it were to turn out that way, if the laws of nature were to allow this variety, then that would give an answer to this tuning mystery, because then there could be many Big Bangs, and their aftermaths could lead to universes very different. And if there's a huge number, let's not debate whether it's an infinite number or a finite number, but there would be some in which conditions were propitious for complexity, including us, to emerge. I should emphasize, we don't know the way the laws of nature will pan out, but one scenario is that there will be a theory that allows a whole lot of Big Bangs, a multitude of them, not just one.
China?
Well, where to pick that up? I think that's quite right. There, ultimately, I think what we keep coming back to is that we don't understand certain things about the laws of gravity and the laws of nature. We don't understand how gravity makes sense in the context of a quantum theory, a theory of the microscopic. And so we know that there's this relationship between the way the universe might be created and the way it looks on a larger scale. And all we can do is conjecture about the many possibilities. And one of the many possibilities is that there are a multiverse, a collection of infinite universes or a finite number of universes, all of which have slightly different properties. Now, we're not at the stage where we can prove it or verify it or really have any predictability. It's just that these are possible ideas that are certainly on the table. They're pieces of a puzzle that we're hoping to assemble to get an ultimate theory beyond Einstein's.
Let me first reassure the listeners who can't see me, but Martin can. I'm not foaming at the mouth. The anthropic principle is certainly a very interesting idea, and Martin is one of the people who's developed its implications very far. Now, I personally prefer, let me just come back and say, we talked about these three different options, that the universe could be going out to infinity very fast, it could be just teetering on the transition line, or it could be going to fall back on itself. That's within the existing framework. In a theory in which it can only change its shape, there's only one possibility, and that's the one where we're teetering on the brink. So I think there could be a fundamental explanation for it.
And you go along with that, would you mind?
I do, but of course you've got to account for the apparent tuning in the other laws of nature that govern atoms and the nuclei within them, which involve a more complicated physics. But I think we all hope there will be eventually some underlying laws of nature that govern the cosmos in a larger sense. But even when we have that, there'll still be two mysteries. One mystery is, how do we understand the way those laws play out and lead to this complexity? And also, why is there a universe? What actualizes those equations into a real cosmos? Why is there something rather than nothing? That's for the philosophers.
Thank you very much, Martin Rees, Julian Barber, and Jan Levin, and thanks for listening.
In Our Time with Melvin Bragg is produced by Charlie Taylor.